Hey everyone, welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. I am Dama Tamanawala, you know my co-host Garrett McGilvery, and joining us today is special guest Gary Whitelaw. Gary Whitelaw is a senior advisor to Bentall Greenoak. He's an investment committee member there, and for over 20 years he was the company's chief executive officer, taking it through a massive evolution, hyper growth, and he has a lot of wisdom to impart. So a few of the things that we're going to talk about today, if you don't know Bentall and what they're about, they have over $62 billion in assets under management, over 60 million in square feet of assets under administration. They're a massive behemoth. So we're going to talk about how to work with institutions. We're going to talk about how to attract institutional capital, which is going to be important for some of you guys as you go on to build massive, colossal companies, hopefully just like Bentall Greenoak. We talk about Bentall's evolution over 100 years, and we talk about commercial real estate macro and micro trends that you can take advantage of. Thanks so much for tuning in. We appreciate you being here. And before we dive in, I want to say a quick thank you to our sponsor, KMB Law, kmblaw.com. Check them out. Thanks and enjoy the episode. Welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. We have a special episode today. We are speaking with Gary Whitelaw, Senior Advisor at Bentall Greenoak, formerly the CEO for many, many years. You know me, I'm Dama Tamanawala. You know Garrett McGilvery, my co-host. And now you're going to get to know Gary. Gary, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me to join you.
Yeah, it's for those of you just listening, we don't have access to Gary's beautiful face today because we had a Microsoft Teams issue. So Gary, just to start it off, Bentall Kennedy was founded over 100 years ago and has become, you know, now Bentall Greenoak, this large institution, this custodian of pension fund capital, trusted name. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the company and how it started?
Sure. It's about 110 years old, so I promise not to go through all of that in chapter and verse. I'd say there's kind of three or four key stages in the company's development over that period of time. It was founded in Vancouver as a construction company by Charles Bentall. And for the first 60 plus years, it was a family-owned company in construction, and then grew and diversified into real estate investment and real estate ownership as well. That was until the mid-80s. Family-owned, family-run, with strong non-family management, but a typical Canadian family company. I think what's relevant from that stage today is that our roots are in real estate at the asset level, in conceiving, building, owning, managing, leasing real estate. So there are a lot of firms that kind of come out of financial services and are maybe more asset allocators that are very good at determining where capital should be placed and moving in, moving out. We like to think that we've developed those skills also, but our roots are at the property level, and we pride ourselves in relating well to the tenants and really being able to create value at the property. And to this day, integrated real estate operations, leasing, development are a very, very big part of our offering in Canada. In other jurisdictions in the world, they're a part of it, but we do it indirectly through partnerships. But here in Canada, we're still very much vertically integrated and have our hands right on the real estate. Around the mid-80s, as they went from second generation Bentalls into potentially a third, the two brothers that ran the company at the time made the decision to bring in institutional capital. And it was actually a very good timing, very prescient move. That happened before real estate blew up in the early 1990s, as some of you listening today might remember, and almost every company in North America and more broadly found itself on the brink of insolvency or actually insolvent. But the Bentall brothers had brought three big institutional investors in the mid to late 80s with a view to creating kind of a public company quality executive team and governance system and everything else. And that gave them to access to capital to expand through the 90s and into the early 2000s at a time when other real estate companies were trying to get back on their feet and deal with legacy issues that were time consuming and distracting for them. But Bentall didn't have that. So that was a period of real growth and expansion for the company. We moved into the US. We bought a little company called Penreal, which was a pension fund advisor, and which in many ways became the future of the company as the next chapter unfolded. The company was public for a number of years, and that worked very well. But you might also remember that in the early 2000s, after the Asian debt crisis, real estate values plummeted. And there was a real public-private arbitrage, and a number of the big Canadian pension funds moved into real estate in a very meaningful way. Ontario Teachers bought Cadillac Fairview, Omers bought Oxford, and the Caisse de dépôt bought Bentall and Cambridge shopping centers, ultimately creating Ivanhoé Cambridge. So we were privatized in about 2001, still majority owned by the Caisse de dépôt, but that was when we pivoted to become a institutional investment manager in the real estate space. And the assets that had been Bentall Corp remained as a separate account for us, but then we began to grow a lot of third-party capital with BCIMC and a number of other Canadian institutions across the country in both separate accounts as well as commingled funds. And then ultimately BCIMC took an ownership position in us. We ended up with the Caisse management and BCIMC owning the company for a number of years. We bought Kennedy Advisors in the U.S., and thus Bentall became Bentall Kennedy. And we ended up with a U.S. business that was about the same size as the Canadian business, obviously in a much bigger market with growth opportunities. So that's kind of the Bentall Kennedy story until about 2015. At that point, with our institutional partners, we realized that the clients' capital was becoming more and more global. Canadian investors were going global. Global investors were coming to North America. And there was consolidation happening amongst managers. So investors that had a choice were going to the bigger managers that offered a range of strategies, not just one thing. So we needed a capital partner. We needed an owner that understood that and had a whole number of assets to contribute to the company's growth, including a strong balance sheet. We went through a strategic process, and Sun Life, with whom we'd had a relationship for about 10 or 11 years at that point, emerged as our clear number one preferred choice. And Sun Life bought Bentall Kennedy in 2015 with a view to growing it very substantially. And that's what led to Bentall Green Oak and to the events of the last 5 or 6 years.
Wow. That's incredible. Okay. That's a lot of information, Gary. You guys have been on a run for a while, and remind our audience too. When did you become CEO of Bentall?
I initially joined as CEO of Penreal in 1998, spring of 1998. Yeah. And then we fully merged with Bentall a couple of years later. And I worked very closely with Mark Sheparsky, who was the CEO of Bentall, hired me and at the time when I joined. And then when Mark left after the privatization in 2001, I took over his role then. So I've been with the company and its predecessors for about 23 years and CEO for about 20 of those years.
That's incredible.
So you were the CEO of the pension fund advisory, correct, Penreal?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And then how did that help evolve Bentall? Because pension fund advisory, you had the connections presumably with a great number of institutions in the United States?
Well, more so in Canada at that time. Okay. Once we acquired, we were developing relationships in the U.S. And when we acquired Kennedy Associates in 2006 or so, that significantly increased our exposure to U.S. institutions like CalPERS, who were big clients of Kennedy at the time.
Okay. And just for some of our listeners that have some of these interests in this particular field, how do you go about getting an institutional partner? Like, how does one go from a shop that's obviously a privately owned family generational company to, you know, getting somebody like, you know, whether it be Case Depot or Sun Life, those types of people interested in, and in, you know, invested in the company itself?
Well, back to the earlier comment about Bentall bringing private institutional investors in before it went public in the late 80s. BCIMC and the Case Depot were two of the institutional investors that came in as shareholders of Bentall. Mm-hmm. And so we got to know each other through board connections, through ongoing, you know, business performance, and quite frankly, them watching the Bentall team, I wasn't there at the time, in the early days, perform really well and develop buildings, run them really well, make a lot of money, and they thought, geez, these guys are pretty good. And as we are developing our own real estate programs, and this was early days, most of the big institutions didn't yet have an active real estate program. Let's see if we can do this together. So what really started out as separate account relationships where they would allocate an amount of capital to us, call it $300 or $400 million, and we'd develop a strategy to invest and manage that capital. Those separate accounts grew significantly. And really our growth from about the time I joined until call it 2005-06 was based on the growth of these accounts for those clients. And, you know, we were fortunate, timing was good. I think the strategy was good. People worked hard. We had very strong returns over a 25 year period for BCIMC from zero to 8 billion at the end. We returned about 13% total return to them compounded annually over that period of time. So, you know, really successful relationship together. And that enabled us to go and talk to other institutions about them coming in and joining us and doing something similar. Most of the institutions weren't big enough to run a separate account program for them, but we developed Penreal had a small commingled fund, which at the time was called West Penn. And when I joined, it was about 150 million or so. And today it's about 7 billion. And it has about 125, mostly Canadian investors, but of late investors from a lot from Europe and from the US. And we're talking to some Asian investors right now. So, you know, we started with a couple of very large and important relationships. Went well for both of us in that regard, and then we broadened out into commingled products for smaller and mid-sized clients.
Gotcha. And how big was Bentall at the time when they first got, as you said, BCIMC and Case Depot involved?
I think the assets were under a billion, probably 700 or 800 million, something like that, Canadian. Yeah. And then by the time we got to the privatization in 2001, Bentall Corp, the public entity's total assets were about $2.2 billion at that time.
Okay. So they're still fairly substantial, pretty large company at that point in time.
Yes.
Yeah. So Gary, so how have, you know, as you guys have continued to grow, and even in your tenure over, you said 23 years, right?
Yep.
Like, how have the opportunities changed? You know, as you guys became Bentall, then Bentall Kennedy, and now Bentall Green Oak, or BGO, as we keep hearing. How have the opportunities changed as you guys have scaled up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, I would start by saying they never stop changing. That's the one thing you have to count on. And you better like that. Initially, it was about markets, you know, city markets and sub markets, and product types. Mm-hmm. You know, shopping centers might have been the flavor of the day, not so much today. Suburban office was where the growth was for many, many years, and then it pivoted to downtown office. Industrial ebbed and flowed, but was kind of not very sexy and interesting, but it sure is today, etc. The other dynamic that continually changed was sources of investment partners. You know, the first part that I just described is kind of the investment strategy or the investment thesis. The second part is who's your capital partner in this? Initially, it was the largest Canadian pension funds. Many of them, as we all know, have very successfully grown, and with that growth, integrated their investment and, in some cases, management operations internally, like the case, like BCIMC with Quadrille, OMERS with Oxford, et cetera. And so we continue to do kind of specialized things with those big clients in product types or geographies where they feel they don't have the resources themselves. Increasingly, the capital partnerships began to evolve with mid-sized Canadian pension funds who had the resources to define a strategy, but didn't necessarily have the scale or resources to execute that strategy entirely on their own. So they would be the client investor with a very close strategic relationship with us, but we'd do much of the execution, and we would go to them with strategies and ideas. So that's one of the evolutions, and I would say that's continued. We've seen more and more Canadian pension funds establish a strong foothold in the Canadian market, but it's limited in scale. We have more capital than opportunities in many ways. So they've begun to follow in the footsteps of their large peers by moving offshore and investing in the US, investing in Europe and in Asia. And that's been this global capital trend, which has been one of the most prevalent trends in the last couple of years. And you know, I'll come back to that later when we maybe talk a little bit about the Green Oak transaction. Behind all of that is the ever-changing dynamics of the property market, and which assets are overpriced, which markets are overbuilt, where do we see growth opportunities going forward? And of course, in many ways, the pandemic has accelerated a lot of those changes.
Yeah, maybe that's just a perfect segue into where you do see opportunities right now, and especially with the pandemic. You know, we keep hearing, I think last year, you know, I remember talking with Dennis Mitchell from Starlight, Garrett and I, and he was just beds and sheds, that's what they like, right? Multifamily and industrial. And with one question I have for you is, with everybody's attention on multifamily and industrial, are you starting to see opportunities open up in office, retail, you know, other asset classes?
Yes, but there's a but there. Okay. I think the ever interesting thing is what you see in terms of property level dynamics and growth opportunities and the tenure or security of the income versus the pricing. And as you were saying a second ago, you know, if everybody likes industrial and multifamily, it's going to be pretty expensive. So you've got to think awfully hard about how you make money in the favored asset class at that period of time. And I think a lot of that comes down to how your capabilities in managing the asset. In our case, often in developing the asset, so you can capture that creation premium that a merchant developer might otherwise take as his profit. If you can build to core and keep the asset after, you've created that gain for your client. That's how we tend to be doing it these days in the favored asset classes of multifamily and industrial. But I think also there are some subsectors that are emerging that were emerging. We started investing in cold storage many years ago now as a subset of our industrial partnership with CalPERS. We have a company called International Logistics Partners, ILP, that has about 2.3 billion US in industrial, all kind of newer state of the art. And a fair bit of that of late has been cold storage. We've been getting a bit of a premium for that, but more to the point, it's less picked over, and you don't see quite as much irrational exuberance in that sector. So we think that e-commerce and direct-to-consumer food supply has really accelerated the demand for cold storage. We made a significant investment in one of the world's leading pre-IPO cold storage companies about 4 months ago, and we just had our first close this week in a dedicated cold storage fund. So we think as a subset of industrial, that's an area of particular interest if you have the depth and expertise. Like anything else, you can get your fingers burned if you don't really know the ins and outs of that subsegment. A lot of people also think that data centers are a very interesting segment. We've got a significant investment program underway in that, in Europe, in Scandinavia in particular, in the US and of late in Canada. And there's some other segments like health sciences and medical office in the US in particular, where the healthcare system is quite different, where we think that's a really interesting, kind of not so much a business cycle driven segment as it is a demographically driven segment, and thus complementary to other things. You know, the one other point that I should just add in terms of investment opportunities, Mark Carney said this in the paper, I guess it's probably 6 weeks ago, that investment in green technology and sustainable assets is a multi-generational opportunity. And I think he's right. You can all debate the pace of change, but it really is a tremendous investment opportunity if you really know what you're doing. So I think putting an ESG lens on your investment programs and thinking about obsolescence down the road, buildings that might be okay today but are not in sustainable markets or not climate resilient, are at risk of obsolescence.
Interesting. And like at that side of the technology spectrum, like what are you seeing that's innovative? Like when we had Jeff Smith from Elliston on, that was like one of his main things that he was hammering home is just, sustainable building. What are you seeing on that front?
Well, it's a really broad range. I mean, I think it starts with market selection. You have to think about location. We were, a very long way down the road in due diligence on a $400 million acquisition a couple of years ago. But the more and more we looked at the location, the more we felt the old floodplain, and this was in the greater Vancouver area, the old floodplain maps were probably not relevant today. And with greater frequency of big storms and things like that, there were some soil conditions that were beginning to emerge that we thought would get worse. And we actually walked away from the transaction because we felt it was just not in a climate resilient location. And, you can apply that to cities, Miami, other places where you have to worry a little bit about what happens over the next 10 or 15 years. That's at kind of a macro level. Micro level, city like San Francisco is a gross rent market. So tenants sign up not for rent, net rent plus taxes and operating costs. They pay gross rent with some sort of tax adjustment clause. That means that every dollar you can save in energy costs fall straight to NOI. It's not something that you can recover over time as you release the building with lower operating costs. It goes straight to the landlord. And so we've been able to go in and buy buildings in that market, for example, and others that are gross rent markets that we think have been really poorly managed from an energy or waste perspective, and save 15-20% on operating costs that fall straight to the bottom line. So those are things that you can do that are obviously good for the environment, but really good for your investor.
Interesting. That speaks to Toronto as well, right? So that's, there's a ton of interesting opportunities here too. So you know, obviously you guys have an international outlook and reach. So Gary, one thing I was curious about, like during the pandemic, everybody has different thoughts on Trudeau, unless you're in real estate, because they're all pretty much the same then. But like, how is Canada perceived in the international markets? Are we, you know, have we leveled up a bit? Is it more attractive to capital? Is it less attractive now? How are we doing?
Well, I think it's partly pandemic. It's partly, relative politics and stability of climate. I don't mean physical climate as much as political climate. I think Canada's been seen as a pretty sane place in which to do business over the last 5 years, and we benefited from that. Certainly some of the policies that were very unfriendly to skilled immigration in the US until recently, until the change in administration, favored Canada. You know, we had a brain gain rather than a brain drain, and Canadian universities were doing really well. And I'll speak personally, I was very pleased to see Biden and Harris elected. They're, I think, going to be much more rational and more globally friendly. But there are still questions about whether that's for the next 4 years or is that for the next 8, 12, 16 years. And so I think Canada's seen as a very amenable place to move to and build a career and to invest capital. And we're seeing a lot of interest from Europeans and now from Asians. But I will tell you, it is in both cases, it is significantly ESG dependent. Those are environments where institutional capital are very aware of ESG. We have big Dutch pension funds who have hundreds of millions of dollars with us. And I think it's primarily because they see us as a global leader in ESG, and they like the returns, both. You got to have both, not one or the other. And we're seeing that now out of Japan and out of Korea, where it's becoming really significant. So for Canada to have what is seen as a responsible energy policy by global investors is also a big part of our selling proposition these days.
Okay, I don't want to derail the whole conversation, but one thing, like, you know, just Garrett touched on this, how did you start those institutional partnerships? Let's say we have a company who owns a few buildings now. Like what is their best route to become a future Bentall? Now I know 110 years old, so it takes a while, but what are the steps that you need to take? And as a follow-up question, do you see any future Bentalls out there right now that are actively moving and shaking, you know, Canadian companies that we might know about?
I think we've always had a saying in the company, and it was really incorporated in our statement of corporate values. Do the right thing for your client. And, you know, that may sound like motherhood, but if you really think hard about what's the right thing in every situation, it takes the gray out of what might be otherwise complicated decisions. So, you know, I'll give you an example. If you're owning a building, if you're managing a building owned by one client or a series of clients, it's their capital. You may have co-invested in it, but it's predominantly their capital, and you're getting asset management, property management, leasing fees off it. You can perhaps talk yourself into keeping that building indefinitely. But there are times when market conditions change, and it's time to sell the building and either reap a gain before it disappears, or minimize a loss before it gets bigger. And that isn't always in your best interest in the short term, but I'm here to tell you that it's always in your best interest in the long term. That people know that, you know, they have a sense of who is truly the steward of their capital and really treating it like it was their own, as opposed to someone who's kind of there for the short-term gain and the fees. So I don't mean that to sound like a platitude, but I think that's the mindset you have to have as you approach every investment. And let's be honest, most of this capital that we're investing is people's life savings. And you know, we should acknowledge that and treat it accordingly. I think the other thing is, I remember Mark Sheparsky saying this to me when he hired me a long time ago, that in real estate, you can get distracted by bright, shiny buildings and the cost of capital and forget very quickly that it's like many other things, but I think in particular, a people business. And if you don't have really good people with you and around you, you can't do it all yourself. It's not the kind of business where one person, unless you're very small scale, where one person sits in a room and makes all the decisions and just barks out orders and people go in and do them. I think you need dedicated, collaborative, motivated people around you. And that means you got to treat them well, you know, both culturally and financially. One of the things that was a big, big contributor to our success at Bentall was management ownership. You know, when we first created Bentall Capital, the iteration that occurred after the case privatized Bentall Corp, management owned 45% of the business. And until the day we sold to Sun Life, we owned 33% of the business. Today, under BGO, management owns about 34% of the business. So, you know, that's a big motivator, and it helps you attract the best people. They think like entrepreneurs, and I think if you can figure out a way to make a formula like that work, medium to long term, it's very powerful.
I'm wondering, like, what are some of the more entrepreneurial moves that you've had to make in at Bentall, or been lucky enough to perform? Like, what, you know, in 23 years at Bentall, actually, you know what, maybe this is a good opportunity to speak about the Green Oak transaction or deal. Can you share a little bit about that, Gary?
Yeah, by all means. And I was going to point to that and a few other related things as an example of your question about being entrepreneurial. We combined during my time, we combined with seven other firms over the years to grow in areas where we did not have the expertise or boots on the ground. And, you know, I guess that's the other thing I neglected to mention about successfully growing your business. You know, you need to have a track record that people can believe in, and the people associated with that track record still there. In other words, you didn't buy a track record and everybody left, but you merged with an entity that had particular expertise in a certain geography or a certain type of product that we didn't have. So that's largely why we combined, was to develop skills and be able to demonstrate a track record to investor clients in particular strategies or geographies. So the Kennedy combination, when we became Bentall Kennedy, was challenging in many ways. It was, you know, just before the GFC, so the first couple of years looked pretty ugly. You know, we had to borrow money as shareholders to fund that acquisition, and there were days when our loans were underwater, and that didn't feel real good. But it also brings you together as a group of partners in a way that is, I think, more powerful than just, you know, being colleagues. Mm-hmm. So the Green Oak transaction was really the result of our combination with Sun Life. We knew that in order to grow globally, we were going to need more capital than our shareholder base had. We needed a company that had global reach and experience. Sun Life is, I think, today 160 years old, makes us look like a kid, and had operations in 22 countries around the world, that had so for 99 years or something at that time. So they really knew how to operate globally, and we had U.S. experience, but not much beyond. first thing we did was look at the trends and forces shaping the industry. And I've mentioned globalization and I've mentioned manager consolidation. And we realized that what investors wanted was a trusted relationship that could bring them a series of complementary strategies. Not try to be all things to all people, but not just one thing or two things, because cycles ebb and flow, right? So we set out to look for either one complementary partner that was in geographies that we weren't, Europe and Asia specifically, and in product lines that we weren't, more value add or opportunistic and more in global credit than we were, or a series of smaller entities that we would combine with and kind of bolt on to grow that combined scope. And we started down the bolt-on path. We bid on a couple of entities that were looking for strategic partners. But an opportunity with Green Oak emerged. My good friend and colleague, Amy Price, who we hired about 9 years ago as COO in the U.S. and was really designated as my successor, you know, subject to a merger or something, as in fact happened. Amy, who ran the U.S. operation, was based in San Francisco, had worked at Morgan Stanley prior to joining us with Sonny Kelsey, John Carrefield, Chris, and many others that now spun off and formed Green Oak. So they had stayed good friends. Amy was having dinner with Sonny. They were each talking about their growth plans and things they were looking at, and we discovered that we actually had a lot in common. So out of that dinner came a preliminary conversation. The more Sonny and Amy and I talked, the more we felt there was something really interesting here. The senior folks like Steve Peacher at Sun Life got very involved, Dean Connor. And you know, what began as preliminary conversations became very serious conversations after a couple of months. But we did spend almost 18 months talking through how governance would work, how shareholdings would work, what the valuation mechanism would be over time, different roles and all those things. So from a fairly quick letter of intent to signed transactions agreement, there was a lot of time spent working through the issues that often you don't think about until after you get married. And it can be more difficult at that point in time because you haven't really had an opportunity to think them through. So the primary rationale, and I think it's played out, was that together we would offer a broader range of strategies with from core to core plus to value added, real estate equity, real estate credit in Canada, in the US, in UK, continental Europe, and developed Asia. With a Sun Life balance sheet to support this, invest in our products alongside our other clients, and help us grow. And you know, it's thus far still relatively early days, but it's been almost 2 years. It's going pretty well. We you know, in spite of the pandemic last year, we raised $4 billion U.S. in new investment capital for investment around the world. And there's just no way in the world Bentall Kennedy could have done half that on her own without the range of product and the geographic scope that Bentall Green Oak now has.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an interesting evolution of the company there. Yeah, you guys are obviously turning to be a heavy hitter in the global markets. Having some life behind you obviously adds to that.
How much money did you raise last year, Garrett?
Me? Oh. not anywhere near $4 billion.
Yeah,
let's say it's less than that.
Wait till you're 110 years old. You'll
yeah, be. Okay. Hopefully, I'm around at that point in time. We'll see. One question that I had: you had obviously a very illustrious, long experience with Bentall Kennedy. If you had to do it all again, would there be anything that you would have done differently?
Yeah, good question. I'd say two things. One, you sometimes tend to become preoccupied with your challenges or your problems and not cut bait quickly enough, you know, admit that something wasn't exactly as you thought it was going to go, and work out a strategy, it's sort of an exit strategy or a mitigation strategy quickly. If you do that, it means your time and energy is finite. It means you're not spending as much time on opportunities as you might. Mm-hmm. So I think a little less on problems and a little more on opportunities. That applies to people as well as investment strategies. And then the second thing is, I think sometimes when you see an opportunity, you can want it to be perfect. You know, what's the saying, that perfection is the enemy of the good? There's some things that we saw early in the revolution that I wish we had done a little bit more of. Not bet the farm more of, but rather than trying to feather in over 5 years, maybe a feather in over 3 years, you know, just move a little more quickly. So have conviction, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. U.S. multifamily, coming out of the financial crisis, we saw what my colleague Doug Putas identified as a generational opportunity in multifamily. It took some time to assemble the capital and make sure we had the right markets and things. But I think if we had made a bet twice the size of the bet we made, it would have worked out extremely well without really having that much more downside.
You were also the chair of RealPAC, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So how does RealPAC influence real estate policy in Canada?
Well, let me start by saying that I think Michael Brooks and the team at RealPAC does an awesome job, and I think we're really blessed to have Michael and the team there. I was on the board of the U.S. associations as well for many years, and while it's very effective, it isn't as tight and collegial and focused, I think, as RealPAC is. RealPAC has made a difference in a number of different ways. There was a time when municipalities were going to tax parking lots and parking structures, and you know, you think about the parking lots that shopping centers and industrial plants and others have, and it would really have hurt the economics of those investments, and RealPAC intervened. We forget about it now, but there was a period in Ontario where very onerous rent control was on the verge of being announced, and once again RealPAC jumped in, lobbied, I think is sometimes a pejorative term, but I think they did a terrific job advising the policymakers of the issues, bringing the industry and the government together to address those. And you know, they're not the only ones, but they represent us not only in each province but across Canada with the federal government. They were very early to champion ESG at the federal level, and I think we're in part that's the reason why we haven't seen particularly onerous legislation introduced, because the government's convinced that the industry is taking it seriously and acting on, you know, necessary initiatives.
Interesting. Again, just firing off these questions, so they might not necessarily all be related. You talked about the potential benefits, or sort of the potential opportunities that you're seeing sort of in the marketplace in terms of, you know, some subsectors of industrial, stuff like that, cold storage. Are there any looming risks that you can see that are coming into that 5 to 10 year term, whether that be, you know, maybe due to the money printing and potential inflation, things like that?
Yeah, I think inflation, as you mentioned, is one that pops to mind. You know, it's always dangerous when you say it's different this time. So I don't know whether it's really different this time. We're seeing deficits run up. I'm sure there are people that remember the early 90s. When Canada really lost control of its monetary policy because we had so much debt, and it was primarily in the hands of foreign investors that demanded a risk premium on our bonds. And that meant that the government was not free to reduce interest rates or to invest in other imperatives because so much of their revenue was going to debt service. So I do worry about that and what that means to interest rates, and therefore what that means to cap rates and values. That said, I don't think that's a near-term risk. Probably the biggest issue, I think, is how are we going to generate a reasonable return without taking on too much leverage or too much risk? You know, it used to be that you could count on a 6 or 7% income return from real estate. We know that's not the case today for most real estate. So you've got to find other ways of getting at that. And while bond yields are so low, that spread seems acceptable. But if bond rates start to tick up, we could find ourselves scrambling. Rising tide makes everybody look pretty good, but the receding tide, not so much.
And sorry, just to circle back to that money printing question, you said it's not so much a near-term problem. When is it a problem? What's the estimate when we should be, we just talked about locking in 10-year money. You know, when should we start to be concerned?
Well, we've seen inflation tick up towards 2%. I mean, the good news is I think central banks know how to deal with inflation much better than with deflation. But once inflation expectations become embedded in people's minds, it's very hard to unwind that. So I think in maybe 3-4 years, we'll have a pretty good sense as to whether we were able to manage our way through these historic low interest rates or whether there's a piper to pay. I don't think it's this year. It's not the next 18 months, I don't think. But as we come out of the pandemic and people start to spend and travel again, it'll be interesting because I think there will be supply shortages and backlogs and much less global trade that could fuel inflation.
Interesting. Now we're coming really close to the end, but I've got a few rapid fire questions as well. What was your best day in real estate and worst day in real estate?
I think one of my best days in real estate was the day that we shook hands with Sun Life. I think that was a real step function, a real step change for us and great people, and it enabled us to then move on to other things. Worst day, I think the toughest day for anyone, I think, is when you lose a really valued employee or friend or colleague. They decide to move on, and you're often very, very happy for them, but it hurts. And you know, they're thankfully there haven't been that many of those along the way, but there have been a few where we lost a good friend or a good colleague to a competitor or to some other career opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And last question, if you had, $5 million right now that you're choosing to invest in real estate, where would you put it?
I probably put it in medical office. Oh. I really think that, and frankly, a little bit less so in Canada because we have national healthcare, but in the US, I think, trying to get the cost of their healthcare system down to manageable levels and out of acute care facilities and into ambulatory facilities. I think that's a fascinating field. Life sciences and healthcare.
Very interesting. Okay. Gary, thank you so much for being with us. I know that our audience is going to get a lot from this discussion. So thank you for today.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it very much. Stay healthy, everybody.
Thank you, Gary.
All right. You too.
Thanks so much for listening. This is the end of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please remember to like, comment, subscribe, the whole nine yards. It really helps the channel grow, the podcast grow and reach more people, and allows us to book even cooler guests. And let us know in the comments who you want to hear from. We love to hear from you guys about what you want to hear. We're always trying to make this podcast more relevant, more exciting, and more informative. So let us know. And have an amazing day.